Good afternoon, everyone. I never know for sure if I should say good evening or good afternoon at 4 o'clock, but especially when it's daylight savings, it feels like it's still afternoon. But in any case, welcome to this final university colloquium of the year. We're very pleased to have Janine Wadle with us today. Janine is a university professor at George Mason University in the School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs. She's done a lot of writing. She's an expert on Poland, and she's done a lot of writing as well on the issue of political and power elites and corruption in state and elite institutions. Today she's going to be talking to us about her new book, Unaccountable: How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedom, and Security. She got a lot of attention a few years back with another book also on the elite called Shadow Elite: How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And that book won the Gravemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. She's published other books as well. Also works as a public intellectual, writing op-ed pieces in a number of the major newspapers in the country, and frequent columnist for the Huffington Post. She's a four-time Fulbright Fellow, and I'm not going to read you the whole list because I'd be up here for 45 minutes. She's a social anthropologist who has gone where few anthropologists have gone, into the areas that usually interest political scientists and economists, but has taken an anthropological perspective on how these elite networks work. She's helped to found a section within the American Anthropological Association called the Association for the Anthropology of Policy. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what she has to say. Welcome, Janine.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's great to be here. I'm delighted to visit the EMU campus. I actually grew up in a similar place, the Bethel College campus, with Mary Sprenger pretty much on the same block. So I'm delighted to have a point of comparison, and I'm delighted to be here in Virginia. And let me begin by asking, well, what do you think when you hear the word corruption? Is it a bribe? Is it Virginia Governor McDonnell, or Governor and his wife, who were convicted on counts that included bribery and fraud? A jury found that they broke the law, but did they distort public policy in any meaningful way? Will their actions compromise our pocketbooks, security, or health, or lead to deep and lasting inequalities? When compared with practitioners of what I call the new corruption, the answer, I think, is no. In the new corruption, no envelope is passed under the table. No laws are clearly broken, but those who violate our trust, but those who practice it violate our trust, and their actions reap consequences far more damaging, I would say, than the McDonald's accepting an engraved Rolex. More and more, the modus operandi of these practitioners seems to be just the way things are done. It's just the way things work. It's how people are operating. And more and more, I'm seeing the same lack of accountability in our organizations and among power brokers that I saw as a young anthropologist in Eastern Europe, both during and after communism. I was 5 when I started working in communism, Poland under communism. Unaccountability is a necessary, though not sufficient, condition of the new corruption. Unaccountability is a necessary, though not sufficient, condition of the new, what I call the new corruption. So today I'd like to address these questions, these issues. One is structured unaccountability. It's a mouthful. I'll explain it in a minute. Two is how unaccountability has become practically endemic among top power brokers. Three, why do these players not fall under the experts' definition of accountability? And four, what we can do about it. And I'd like to very much hear from you on that. So one, structured unaccountability. Whoops. Oh, here we go. Structured unaccountability. So many corporate and government organizations now immunize themselves from accountability, leaving those subject to those organizations helpless. In the old world, and when I say the old world, I mean about 25 or 30 years ago, before some of you were born, but just seems like yesterday for some of the rest of us. In the old world, it was easier to identify who was in charge. But in this new world, interactions of the digital age have disconnected the official or the bureaucrat from the client, that is from us, in ways that never before were possible. And with the bulk of technological expertise and data in the hands of big companies and big government, the system can reach out and touch you, but you can't it. Bureaucracy is organized into silos and information universes with bits and bytes of information separated from each other and treading in a sea of digital routines. So think banking in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. The bankers, you probably know, were repackaging mortgages and they were selling them, and they were focused on just clicking off the number of deals that were done. The focus was not on the client. The focus was as it would might have been or was supposed to be in the old Weberian bureaucracy. So the focus was not on the client, let alone the eventual outcome of the deals or society. Sociologists and anthropologists of finance have argued that this kind of siloization and splintering of information actually facilitated the financial crisis. And in fact, it was sociologists studying the financial crisis who'd done a lot of work with interviewing bankers who coined this term structured unaccountability to describe how banks were operating, trading in this system of complex derivatives and how the banks themselves were organized. Complex derivatives, by the way, signal a crisis of truth that runs deep. In the old world, banks knew more or less what holdings they had, and traders knew the value, more or less, of what they were trading. Recall the expression, let's listen to what the market says. Markets were said to function as harbingers of truth and barometers of the state of the world. They were juxtaposed with politics, right? But today, prices are more disconnected from reality. The value of complex derivatives is rather unclear. Madame Beauregard with a crystal ball might be able to tell you what's in your derivative. In the financial collapse, people saw these investments sink, not quite aware that bankers were slicing and dicing mortgages into financial Frankensteins. So think too of Goldman Sachs, often described as derided as Government Sachs for its seamless enmeshing of Wall Street and Washington. In the years leading up to the financial crisis, Goldman routinely pushed the envelope. One great example of this is something called the Abacus case, in which it sold certain prized investments to a powerful clients, and then it sold other investments that it predicted would fail to other not prized clients that turned out to be pension funds and such, right? So they were set up to fail. And Goldman also famously helped Greece hide debt in the early 2000s. And when the day of reckoning came for Greece, of course, it wasn't Goldman Sachs, elite insiders, or national leaders who paid the price of austerity measures. So my point is that accountability has been laundered out of much of the system, and deniability is a great new perk of power. Okay, so this is deniability. Yeah, I guess I better pay attention here. So see nothing, hear nothing, see nothing, speak nothing. So welcome to the new world of 21st century corruption, where the buck stops nowhere. And this corruption centers on unaccountability, structured unaccountability, and it's systemic. So now let's move to point two, which is how do top power brokers operate in this system? And I argue that that top power brokers are very often unaccountable, and their actions are much harder to detect, more so than any time in recent memory. Players today have a multiplicity of affiliations and therefore motives. Our culture has changed so fast and furiously in the past few decades that most of us don't even pause to think about the implications of that. So in the old world, it would have been unthinkable for former leaders of the free world to use the prestige of their former office to create highly lucrative and influential brands, an emphasis on the word brand. But in the new world, Tony Blair, former British Prime Minister, created what's been dubbed Blair Inc., which the British newspaper, The Telegraph, describes as a confusing mix of business, politics, and philanthropy that's administered by a complex system of companies. Blair has advised Wall Street banks, European insurers, the government of Kazakhstan, among other governments, and even the government of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, while counseling Gaddafi, for instance, on deals that J.P. Morgan, the investment bank, wanted. He also served as an advisor to J.P. Morgan and, additionally, as an official peace envoy to the Middle East. Also in the New World, Bill Clinton, after leaving office, in addition to creating the Clinton Foundation and its global initiative, has served as a paid advisor to a global private equity and consulting firm, among other business ventures. His close aide recruited philanthropic donors to be clients, and as the New York Times put it, some Clinton aides and foundation employees began to wonder where the foundation ended and the business began. And think of the potential boundary issues represented by that band of gold. What seems to be new here is that Clinton and Blair are merging business, philanthropy, policy, and the boundaries are either not there or moving boundaries. So, I mean, in the past, we had Gerald Ford. He retired. He went to serve on boards of directors. We had Jimmy Carter. He retired to do philanthropic work. This is a new model where they're all merged, and you can't tell where one begins and one ends. So one finding that emerges from my work is that the rise of a new type of flexible power broker who can connect the dots is a signature feature of our era. So here's a power broker with multiple roles symbolized by multiple cards. And the fact that we're in a system of structured unaccountability where major organizations are so siloized seems to help create the need for the very players who can bust the silos and operate across them. And that's exactly what people like Blair and Clinton are doing. And all of this, in any event, signals a seismic change over the past several decades that's been brought about by, privatization, the dispersion of global authority after the end of the Cold War, and, of course, digital technology, the digital age. Today's zeitgeist is all about informal arrangements, and we don't now just have Uber and Lyft and Airbnb as the sort of informal economy, but we also have the informalization of power, and that's what I've been charting. And the result is that top power brokers are highly flexible, and they're operating under the radar, and it makes it easy for them to abuse the system to their advantage and to violate our trust. Now, of course, what they're doing is not necessarily unethical, but we, the public, have an information problem. We can't know exactly what they're up to because they're not accountable by conventional means. That's why, despite the unaccountability systems in place and today's emphasis on transparency, you've all heard about transparency and accountability, true accountability seems to be in short supply, whether we're talking about corporate and government organizations or major leaders and influencers. The players I chart operate in arenas from healthcare and homeland security to finance and foreign policy. So, take, for instance, the activities of 19 highly influential and highly regarded academic economists who promoted specific financial reform proposals and gave expert advice to public bodies like congressional subcommittees and committees on the merits of these proposals before, in the run-up to the financial crisis, and after it. Academic economists, without disclosing their links to private financial institutions, usually banks. A University of Mass Amherst study found that the majority of the time the economists did not identify their affiliations and possible conflicts of interest. So again, we have an information problem. We don't know that they might have another agenda that affects the advice that they're giving to the public. Or consider what are called key opinion leaders, which is a term developed by pharmaceutical companies. These are prominent physicians or medical researchers who are paid or perked by companies, pharmaceutical companies, to convince their fellow professionals that a particular company's product is the most efficacious. And this is a post-Cold War phenomenon. I first began to see it in Eastern Europe. And in Western Europe, there's research done on it now in the United States, Latin America. It seems to be all over the world. According to a Queen's University study, these key opinion leaders by certain measures have tripled in the past decade plus. And the problem here is that their sponsorship isn't often disclosed, and it's very subtle ways of influencing. So we go to our physician, and even our physician doesn't know that how this particular course of treatment or this drug or even the fact that this disease is identified as such came to be. And very often, it frequently has to do with the role of key opinion leaders who are often, as I said, prominent physicians who are also, leaders in medical schools, leaders on national boards, work with the FDA, and so on. And what the problem is that they're getting paid or perked also to push a particular thing. But always people use their most prestigious titles when they go on the air. They don't say, oh, I'm with, X company. They say, I'm with Harvard University, right? That's the model. Okay. These experts define the terms of the debate and act as their gatekeepers, whether we're talking about the economy or about healthcare. We, the public, are led to believe that they're playing on our team when in fact they may not be. because while appearing as impartial authorities, they champion a particular product or policy without divulging that they have that it benefits an industry or company for which they consult. And this, I would say, is a violation of our trust. Now, consider two retired generals and admirals. My shadow influence project has been given privileged access to two databases, one in finance and one in the defense arena, and I'm going to talk about the defense arena now, that illustrate these power brokers in action and how unaccountability has grown over time. A groundbreaking study by the Boston Globe in 2010 amassed a database of more than 750 retired generals and admirals over a quarter of a century, and my Mapping Shadow Influence project has added to this database. And looked at what we're doing is looking at the post-retirement careers of retired generals and admirals in this country. It used to be 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that when they retired, they, you know, went to play golf or they play with their grandkids. But over the past several decades, they've gone mostly from actual retirement to mostly continued service in the defense industry. Now, they typically retire at a young age, and they live longer than in the past. And while it might be perfectly reasonable that they continue working, should we, the public, simply look the other way? Some of them pursue a multi-pronged strategy that affords them money and influence. So this image shows a network of companies, government entities, and nonprofits that are connected through retired generals and admirals. As the Boston Globes and other investigations have found, some retired officers are paid advisors in military agencies, while at the same time they work for consultants in to defense and intelligence contractors. Others sit on government advisory boards, so quasi-governmental boards that give them access to privileged information and people, and then they can parlay that information and access that they have into their other roles, like consulting for the defense industry. And a new pattern just in the past few years is that they start their own venture capital companies. They launch startups. So this long-time trend has been accelerating. So if we look, this is how it looked in 1992, and we have put together a slide with my team of computational social sciences folks of what the picture looks like every 2 years. So the circles, the dots are individuals. Anytime you see a circle or a dot, they're individuals. The lines are business relationships that connect individuals. Everybody got that? So the circles are people, the lines are business relationships between people, meaning like, for instance, we work together in the same company. So let's look at a 20-year trajectory from 1992 to 2002. See, those people are going to work with each other over here. 1996, 98, 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006. Right, so what they're doing is they're following each other into the same firm. They're starting, as I said, these venture capital companies. They're serving on the same boards. Reflecting on this trend, Senator Jack Reed, a West Point graduate, said this: "When I was an officer in the 1970s, most general officers went off to some sunny place and retired. Now, the definition of success is to move on and become successful in the business world." Definition of success. What does that mean to you. It means that the culture has changed along with these other changes. So even in the military, where devotion to the institution is supposedly paramount, there's been a shift from institution to self. What does this mean for accountability? In these and other arenas, whether defense, healthcare, economics, whatever arena you choose, many power brokers haven't considered, most likely, the unaccountability inherent in the overlapping roles they craft for themselves. They're mostly not bad apples, but their patterns of activity leave us, the public, again, in the information age, in the age of transparency, without crucial information, without an easy way to untangle these roles. So how can we know whether they're more concerned about their companies, the retired generals, financial interests, or those of the nation, or the taxpayers? We can't know. And we used to have more help from journalism, which has been decimated. We have to, investigative reporting in this country. We have to rely on the few investigative reporters left to unearth some of this. Then there are the players that I call shadow lobbyists, and Linda Keenan and I coined this term in the Huffington Post a few years ago. Shadow lobbyists choose not to register as lobbyists when they're quite obviously wielding influence that we can't see or trace. So prevalent have their activities become that shadow lobbyists are giving registered ones a run for their money. So the number of registered lobbyists in Washington has actually declined by nearly 21% from 2007 to 2014. The number of registered lobbyists declined by nearly 21% according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And do you think that's because influencing has been disappearing? I argue that it's because a new model that's more difficult to detect has been coming to the fore. The business of influencing has changed so much that the American League of Lobbyists, that's the trade association that deals with lobbyists, decided to adopt the more innocuous Association of Government Relations Professionals. Okay? So, and the president of the organization said in a letter to members, "We discovered that a majority of our membership no longer identified themselves as lobbyists." Now, who are shadow lobbyists? They're often former high government officials, now connected with PR firms as strategic advisors. That's a new title that they often have, or with consulting with law lobby firms, and those have become merged in the past few years. Often the public sector, they have public sector or government affairs groups who take on these roles of influence in the corporate world. Many appear in the media as disinterested experts. Again, they're almost always identified by the most prestigious and impartial sounding title. So in this case, it's going to be, you know, former senator is how, or former cabinet official. You're not going to find out that Mr. Chertoff has his own company, even if he's talking about airport security and why we need the full body machines that he's manufacturing. Right, he's going to be identified as former Secretary of Homeland Security, or he has been. So the way the influence is wielded has changed so much that we need to revise our old image of the revolving door. Because the elected revolving door, you've all heard of that. So basically legislators or former legislators or former cabinet officials going to lobbying. But the revolving door still exists. But instead of shuttling players just two ways, there are many more exit and entry points for players. So the pattern has become diversified. In addition to PR firms or law lobbying firms today, some places that Democrats and Republicans go as well as their top staffs, today are think tanks. Full disclosure, I've been affiliated with think tank, and media, PR firms, where they can establish their brands and influence public opinion at the same time. Joining these legions of shadow lobbyists, too, are A-list firms that take business from unsavory regimes to burnish their images. Activity that in the past might have been seen as treasonous, and a lot of this has been enabled by the digital age. One firm employs all sorts of dark arts, their words, on the internet, like setting up third-party blogs that appear independent, gaming search results to ensure that positive content outweighs the negative. Such efforts sway public perception and mold policy, but are virtually invisible, even to a trained observer. Prominent academics are also susceptible to being enlisted as shadow lobbyists. Before Arab Spring, Libya's outlaw image began improving in all probability because it hired the Monitor Group, powered by Washington power brokers and by very prominent professors from Harvard and elsewhere, for $250,000 a month to basically engage in a stealth propaganda campaign. So what these players did was they went to Libya, they met with Gaddafi, they met, in some cases, they met with his son and so on. They had their little tours, and they came back and they wrote op-ed pieces talking about how the Libya was reforming itself. But again, we have an information problem because the op-ed pieces didn't sort of mention that, well, they were being paid to go there and to come back and write some of these things. So again, the problem is that the companies and organizations that sponsor these players fail to reveal what their real agendas and sponsors and networks are, and we, the public, have difficulty finding out. And I'm arguing that that people, regular people, are sensing that something is wrong, and you see this, and something has changed, and you see this in public opinion polls the world over. People, if you look at public opinion polls, you see that people have much less faith than they used to in government institutions, whether it's courts or parliaments. Or government officials, as well as financial institutions, banks. That's faith in banks, trust in banks, has confidence in banks has plummeted, and corporations. Same thing with the media. And I would argue that this is part of why people from Turkey, Greece, India, Brazil, Ukraine, and even the United States, sensing something is amiss, although they have difficulty figuring out who's responsible, are rapidly losing their faith in their country's institutions and leaders. This new unaccountability is leading to grassroots ire in many countries. Classic notions of corruption as the violation of trust appear to be close to the hearts of many protesters and at the core of some of today's most damaging corruption. But while regular people everywhere have been noticing this new style of pervasive unaccountability and beginning to even call it corruption, many of the corruption experts have not. And that brings me to point three, should be here someplace. So why do these players not, that I've just been talking about, why do they not fall under the expert's definition of corruption, as defined, for instance, by the World Bank? Corruption as the abuse of public office for private gain, which often gets reduced simply to bribery. Clues can be found in the evolution of the post-Cold War what's been called the anti-corruption industry, which I saw up close in the 1990s. I was 10 by then. As an anthropologist in Eastern Europe and an occasional consultant for the World Bank, That industry developed under the influence of economists whose models and metrics, I would argue, often led to missing the bigger and perhaps more important picture. So, a 1999 Washington Conference on Corruption, organized by an array of U.S. and international entities, embodies the zeitgeist of the anti-corruption industry. The venue, this upscale Washington Hotel. A keynote speaker at the opening session, the Honorable Robert Rubin. So we've got Bob Rubin, who's Secretary of the Treasury, and of course, past chairman of Goldman Sachs. Okay, can you go to the next? Yeah, great, okay. Past chairman of Goldman Sachs. So, and just a week earlier, he and his deputy secretary, Larry Summers, along with Federal Reserve chairman at the time, Alan Greenspan, were mugging triumphantly on the cover of Time magazine, hailed as the committee to save the world. How well did that work out? At the conference, Rubin lent his heft to one saving the world project, anti-corruption in developing and emerging economies. The lineup with stars like Rubin also included the world's top business lobbies and heavyweights from the United Nations and the OECD. Transparency International, a non-governmental organization, and the World Bank were pioneering efforts to combat corruption. Transparency International sponsors, corporate sponsors, in this era included AIG, Arthur Andersen, Bank of America, Enron, Lockheed Martin, and Pfizer, and who wouldn't want to join the party? This is the late 90s. The U.S. economy was roaring at full blast, despite some market tremors overseas. Wall Street was going gangbusters. And the conventional wisdom was that they could just best police themselves, these players, like the players we just discussed. In this heady atmosphere, the conference participants and their brethren in the business and investment community could crack the problem of corruption in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, do good, and make countries out there more hospitable to their investments. The new corruption, potentially much more harmful to the United States and the West, did not appear to even enter their thinking, even though Washington insiderism and Wall Street malfeasance were already thriving, only to reach their calamitous peak in 2008. Players were engaging in what one Polish sociologist called dirty togetherness, the informal exchange system that pushed the envelope of propriety, but that nearly everyone under communism participated. Okay, and while some of the world's most publicly engaged economists were the brains behind the anti-corruption industry, other economists were serving as handmaidens for investment banks, regulatory institutions, and credit rating agencies as these institutions engaged in some of the boldest violations of public trust in history. So very briefly, several tenets, unspoken tenets of the anti-corruption industry are palpable. One is focus on petty corruption, like having to pay a bribe or to a customs official or to a bureaucrat. Some scholars have called this need corruption because it's driven by everyday people trying to navigate an impossible system to get basic goods and services. So that's what they were focusing on, right? Another is metrics. Economists at the World Bank and Transparency had devised metrics to make sense of corruption in terms of a single number or score. So by the time of the conference, Transparency International was in its fifth year of publicizing the Corruption Perceptions Index that measures every year corruption in countries around the world as perceived by experts and business leaders, and it was focusing public attention on corruption. So a single score, the storylines imply, conveys the corruption of an entire country, and ordering countries by rank shows us how one country compares to another. So in 1999, a typical year, Scandinavian and West European countries ranked the highest, meaning the most clean, we're the best, with the United States not far behind, and who would you imagine is at the bottom, typically? Yeah, well, yes, African countries, Nigeria, Cameroon, usually close to the bottom, Indonesia. So it's easy to see the appeal of this corruption as bribery and of ranking systems, this story. Single numbers released every year, easy to grasp. They're media friendly. Reporters can understand them. They're seductive in their clarity. But does this make sense as public policy? So the mid or low-level bureaucrat in Nigeria or Ukraine, who earns many times less than his Western counterpart, is disparaged for taking bribes to feed his family. Meanwhile, prestige-cloaked practitioners of the new corruption, whose undisclosed roles and influence help shape policy, get a pass. So my point is not that the corruption targets the, you know, bribe-taking officials don't need corruption, that these, that kind of corruption doesn't deserve our attention. It does. But the anti-corruption industry in its heyday was focused so narrowly that by definition, the new corruption and the massive unaccountability inherent in it was nearly excluded. And I should say that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars have gone into this industry by, you know, international organizations, Western governments, international financial institutions, and so on. So, and it's easy for us, too, to focus on old-style, you know, petty, just needs to go to the next one. Anyway, so the media focus on images of traditional corruption and its prosecution. I just need the next one. Yeah, right, so that's good. So, yeah, so, you know, these are headlines in the Washington Post, and these are separate stories, and they're very, you know, they're very well done stories. But, you know, this is something that everyone can understand, right? The Rolex watch, the Ferrari, you know, the sad and troubled wife. We can all get that. But is that really what's going on, right? Is that really the most important thing? And speaking of media, and we can talk more about this in Q&A if you're interested, but there's a fascinating parallel between mainstream media, television in the United States, and media under late communism. I've noted this, but a couple of scholars have focused on this very specifically, and they note the formulaic quality of media messaging. So, in Jon Stewart, if you watch The Daily Show, shows this very effectively. You know, you go from one channel to the next channel to the next channel, and the same words, the same messages are used, the same sort of formulaic, predictable, repetitive narratives. We see them from channel to channel, even in our age of, you know, infinite possibilities, where we can go to any information source we want to. So, How can that be? And what happens is that people's response to that in the United States, as well as in late communism, is to go to parody, because there's more parody that can be conveyed. Parody can convey more truth, apparently, than can the news. And that's exactly what we saw under late communism. Okay. So the dazzle can distract us from seeing the new corruption, yet ordinary people still sense something is awry. As we said, opinion polls show that Americans' trust in its leaders and institutions has plummeted. This too recalls Eastern Europe during late communism, where I witnessed a pervasive feeling of helplessness, fatalism, and gallows humor. Case in point, this headline from a website: when Goldman Sachs settled its abacus case with the U.S. government. Breaking: Goldman did not break any of those laws that it wrote. And finally, what can we do about it? And we need to understand that the most damaging corruption in this country is organized differently from the bribe-taking Nigerian or Ukrainian official. And if we're to deal with it, we need to incorporate that understanding into policy and culture. We need to follow the players, not just the money, because the most today's top players merge business and government, right? They're not, and they break the rules of democratic society with regard to both. They're not interested in the rules of accountability, right, of the democratic state, and they're not interested in the free market. Those rules would be of a competition. So they're not interested in the premises of either of those. And that's why we need to follow the players, because the players specialize in blending and blurring those sectors. And all you have to do is look at the newspapers to see that. So we have to go back to basics to track the influence of, say, the retired generals. We need to understand their roles, activities, networks, organizations, sponsors, and look at how they interact. We need to connect the dots. And we also need to rethink our approach to accountability. True accountability can't be reduced to a checklist or to metrics. Witness the problems in education today. Many parents and educators believe that the system is too fixated on high stakes testing results. Has the focus on metrics actually improved American schools? I think that's highly debatable. And true accountability is not a mere performance for the auditors, whether the auditors are Standard & Poor's, Transparency International doing its corruption perceptions indices, or our donors and funders. It can't be reduced to just a checklist. I do a tick box and I'm great, right? And I submit it and I get my funding. And in conclusion, I wanted to emphasize public trust. Today's society, as we know, is becoming increasingly polarized and siloized. And one thing that we can do is to help facilitate discussion across diverse venues and communities. And on that note, the school where I teach, George Mason University, which is a school of public policy and international affairs, a graduate program, we have a reason I like teaching there is that we have a real diversity of students. We have lots of retired military people. We have who are coming back to do their PhDs. We have people from all over the world, and that's a wonderful venue in which to get people who would never talk to each other. In one class, I had the woman from Saudi with a hijab, the Ethiopian veterinarian, three special forces guys, one woman working for the National Republican Institute, getting them all together in the classroom. And if you're interested, I brought some propaganda for our school on the table. But seriously, what one really sees is people living. We're now in a world where we can live in our own little information universes. We get our information from, you know, whoever we already believe, right? And there isn't much cross-fertilization when you really think about it. And that's something that I think that communities like this can really have a special position, because you do have diversity of people. You can help forge links between people who might not otherwise talk with each other. Today's most damaging corruption, I think, is the violation of public trust, and that harks back to, as I said, classic definitions you can find in the Bible, the Old and the New Testament, and also in the Quran. Definitions along those lines. And the public trust needs to be restored. The alternative is that today we're running the risk of creating a permanent class of outsiders. More and more people appear to be identifying themselves as outsiders. And that's not hard to do if you, you know, if you're 25 and you're unemployed and you have no prospects of being employed. And that's one reason we need to redefine corruption as violation of public trust and not just as illegal behavior or as bribery. And I think that rethinking corruption will move us more towards establishing the broken connection between people on the ground and public institutions. Thank you. And I should say that I brought some more propaganda op-ed pieces that I've been writing in USA Today and Washington Post and so on. I did manage to forget the book flyer, so my publisher will kill me. But anyway,
we have time for just a few questions.
You said that there are retired military personnel taking some of these classes. How are they reacting to your teachings on this?
Well, I don't, how do I answer this? I actually have quite a following with some of the retired military people because one of the things that I teach is we call it advanced field methods, but it's actually on the ground. How do you go do research? And a lot of them are interested in how their own agencies work, and they have to work across agencies and so on. So the perspective that they get a real world grounded perspective. They get a lot of these issues. So I really don't have I enjoy dealing with them in the classroom and outside of the classroom, and there's such a cross fertilization of people in the program. I presented a few of these things in class, but you know, we don't have very many political discussions and overtly political discussions in class. If I don't know that that is helpful, but yeah.
Thank you very much. I find your points compelling. Looking at what it is that can be done, I guess is the big question I have. And it almost seems to me that we've gone past a tipping point, perhaps, that the people who could make a difference, as in the politicians pass laws, they're the very ones that have no incentive to do that. Is that correct, or do we solve this by some other means?
That's for I think my job has been to sort of lay it out and diagnose it. And I think it's very complex set of issues. I mean, with regard to regulation, which you alluded to, I'd love to be able to suggest a host of laws like the progressive reformers did. But there are a couple of things that we need to understand. Again, thinking about a grounded perspective, we need to get that the regulatory process is fluid, and it doesn't end with the president's signature. So if you think, for instance, about Dodd-Frank that was passed after the financial crisis and all of the lobbying and, you know, shadow lobbying that's gone on to weaken it. And, you know, people, again, that's not so media friendly. So people aren't paying attention to that, but it's crucial. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing is we need to pay far more attention to what happens as a result of regulation. So there was a new law on lobbyists passed in 2007, and I could speculate that that's one of the reasons that so many, you know, of my shadow lobbyists have gone underground essentially and not registered. So a smart way to think about it is to anticipate. I mean, you need to kind of be a social anthropo, anticipate what are the potential consequences of this or that law? What are people going to do in response? Right? And so there's no unfortunately, there's no regulatory panacea. And in given that we're in a situation where people don't trust public institutions, I mean, it's a challenge, as they say in the euphemism business, to think out of that. But I don't think it's a lost cause by any means. I think there's a lot that communities can and are doing, actually.
So one of my systems principles is that every system was perfectly designed to achieve the results it's now achieving. We just sometimes have to really back up to see why those results were intended. So the military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex have all perfected the art of getting government to pay for the goods or services that they provide. So as you were pointing out, there is no disincentive whatsoever for that to continue. But would not one response to that be localism? Local economies figuring out how to make things work at the local level, and this more parasitic form of capitalism will eventually play itself out tragically as communism did. These systems are not sustainable, but there are alternatives that we can create at the local level.
Well, I think that's what a lot of communities are doing, I don't know how that. It's hard to say how that's going to play out over time. But that does seem. I mean, the response seems to be this informal solutions for better for worse. Whether it's Uber or Lyft or whatever, or whether it's simply the community garden or the that does seem to be a very a lot of that seems to be very healthy local. Local responses, especially when the stuff at the top is so very hard to control and to know what's really going on. So.
Time for one more yet?
Are there any nations that you consider having like best management practices in confronting this shadow corruption?
I think that it's an empirical question how widespread these dynamics are and this model is. Although I seem to get emails from all over the place, Latin America, Southern Africa, people who read the last book, for instance, Shadow Elite, and saw the same. Relationships, the same dynamics, the same playbook, same patterns playing out, and which would be logical when you think about the what created these dynamics and this new sort of system of power and influence, what created new ways of doing things in the first place. Well, they're developments, transformational developments of the past 25-30 years, it's incorrect to say that they're intended, but there's an interaction of these dynamics that play out in ways that nobody could really have anticipated. Are we ending on a somber note? Oh dear.
So just to kind of affirm, I think what has been interesting for me is I spent a fair amount of time between 2008 and 2012 back and forth between here and Burma, Myanmar. So kind of notorious for this level. And every time I came home, I kept thinking, this looks more and more like Burma. Is it that I just have Burma glasses on? Or is it actually getting worse here? So I think the answer is yes, it's getting worse. But I kept asking myself, where else have I seen this kind of networked influence? And it's actually in the field of peace building and the civil society networks of peace building. I think if we were to trace how people who've had an influence in trying to reduce violence around the world, including people who've studied in our program here and people who work here, it's the same kind of networking influencing pattern. So it seems to me that it's a new way of thinking about how the world is organizing itself. That's a kind of networks and hard.
The networked.
It's the network modeling, right?
Which has been written about. But where the issue comes in.
Yeah.
Because we all have networks, and networks can be marvelous ways to solve problems and do things. And the problem that the violation of public trust comes in when the networks, when the overlapping roles are not disclosed. And we have, and we think that this group is playing on our team, but they're not, because they have another agenda that we don't know about. That's where the problem comes in.
Great. Yeah. So I want to focus on that, because we don't want to lose the positive power of networking.
Right.
Right, so I think being really crisp about what the problem is the lack of transparency and accountability, and so the confusion. And so that would seem to indicate that the part of the solution is knowledge and awareness, and demanding knowledge and awareness. So it's how do we turn the system of information to our needs, to meet our needs.
Yeah, no, I agree, but that transparency is hugely important. But there's a problem when people can be named but not shamed.
Yeah.
And that's also an issue of networks. Some of the networks the interlocking networks that I studied, the players can be named, and they have been named millions of times, but they can't be shamed. And that has something to do, again, with the specific kind. And most of us can be named and shamed, right? And that's the difference between us and them.
And I would just say one other thing about the military. The question that was asked is, I think there's a growing gap between flag officers and the rest in the military. So the elite gap is in creeping into the military in a way that didn't exist when my dad was in the military. Mm-hmm. There wasn't that sense of a gap. Mm-hmm. So I would think a lot of your military people would be just as horrified. And
I think that, yeah. I appreciate that you said that, because I think that, you know, although we don't always go there in conversation, that wouldn't surprise me. And the elite players we're talking about, I mean, think General Petraeus. He's been in the news. Well, so where did he go after after he was disgraced? And, you know, I don't care what he does in his private life. That's not my business. But what's interesting is that two things are very interesting. One is he goes to a private equity firm, right? So that shows something about how our world works, that somebody in the defense industry is opening doors for, you know, is a door opener in private equity. That, again, is a new path, just like we have people from Silicon Valley, young guys who go to NSA. So that's part of it. The other thing is, it shows how it's very difficult to shame somebody like Petraeus, right? He's going to probably get off, even having disclosed this security classified information to his mistress, which most people would go to jail for, right? And are going to jail for. So that's the issue. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.